Interview with Lee Spencer, February 18th, 2009, in New York City, by Kenneth Durr. Well, thank you for taking some time to talk to me. I appreciate it. I want to start by bringing you up to the point where you got to the SEC. A little bit about education. You went to Princeton, I guess?
Right.
Did you plan to go into law school at that point?
Yes, I thought I would. And I studied for a year. I was a philosophy major. I studied a year at the University of Strasbourg in France on a fellowship, and then returned and went to Yale Law School, went and graduated from Yale Law School.
Philosophy major is an unusual route to take to go.
That was interesting. For lawyers, it's analytical. I think it's good to do young and sort of settle with a worldview as well, how to approach life and where I have less anxiety on that subject later.
Huh.
It was also an extremely strong department at Princeton.
Okay. And Yale Law then.
Right.
Did you take any securities courses at that point?
Yes, I had a corporate finance course, which you can buy with Marvin Chilstein, which had a securities element in it, so I had some background in it.
Did that corporate finance course sort of set you on the path that you ultimately took?
I don't think so. I think maybe a... It was also a process of elimination. I think I knew I did not want to be a litigator per se, and that led more to corporate law by nature. And I found it interesting. Again, same thing. I thought it was analytical and challenging.
Okay. And then you went to Sullivan and Cromwell, right?
Correct.
And what kind of work did you do there?
Very extensive securities work. We tended to. It was a tremendous. Opportunity to learn because of the diversity of subject matter. We tended to represent both companies but also investment banks on deals, public offerings of all types. Mm-hmm. And I worked on probably well over 100 financings, and so you saw a tremendous amount being an advantage, I suppose, of Wall Street, which tends to be at the fulcrum of that.
Right.
So, plus the standards of practice were high, and I think I learned better how to do a job right. So
who was your mentor there?
Mentor is a term I don't use.
Yeah.
No one particular person. They were all outstanding people.
And this was in the early 70s?
Mm-hmm, from 1969 to 76. But when I was at Yale Law School in our senior seminar, I had said to my then Professor Charlie Reich, who wrote The Green to America, it was sort of the anthem of the moment. Actually, some of us actually helped teach his undergraduate course at Yale. I said I wanted to practice for a while and then go into the government. But I said you needed some experience. I felt I did, certainly. I had no economic background, knew little about business. But I thought generally in life you could be an infant prodigy in mathematics, but not in human affairs. You needed some experience. And Charlie twitted me a little bit, said, oh, you're going to go just make a lot of money and not do it. But I hung in there and sort of kept my eye out for an opportunity in the government, and the SEC would be a natural place with my background. And sure enough, one popped up, fortunately for me.
Tell me about how it surfaced.
It was through friends, I think, perhaps... former SEC person, colleague was down at the SEC as an assistant to the chairman, I think, and he knew I had expressed this view, and he saw an opportunity, an opening, and called it to my attention. And I went down and was fortunate to obtain the position.
Who was that?
Bob Kraft.
Okay. So did you go into investment management at that point?
Yes, right.
Okay.
And, there were a couple of studies going on at the time. I came in as the chief counsel of the Division of Investment Management. There were a couple of studies going on, and I wound up spending most of my time the first few months on something called the Bank Study, which was a congressionally mandated inquiry into banking inroads in the securities areas. The mutual funds brokers were complaining a little bit about bank activities and comparable regulation. We took several of us took an extended look at that and wrote a long report basically suggesting some modifications of the regulatory structure. Nothing dramatic at that time. And that was the bulk of 76, the remainder of 76. as I recall. And then went on to function as the chief counsel per se, mm-hmm. which is the chief interpretive officer in terms of writing no action letters, that type of legal interpretations, other administrative tasks, which was interesting. The mutual fund area was new to me, so I was fortunate again to learn a great deal for me about mutual funds, an interesting area.
Was Sid Mendelson your division director?
He was not. He was an associate director. And then about a year later, Ann Jones was the director. And went over to another high-level position with another federal organization. And Sidney became the director, and I became one of the two associate directors at that time, simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And I think Rod Hills was the chairman for a short time when I came in, and Harold Williams was the chairman at this time.
Okay.
And I served as associate director for I think about a year.
Well, tell me a little bit about some of the big issues in the investment management area at that point. I mean, clearly the bank study was a response to one of them.
Right.
What else was going on?
There were a variety of things. I would say there were, at that particular time, there was no dramatic, as there came to be in Corp Fin, of overriding regulatory effort. There were a series of smaller adjustments to rules, of which, and we were active in that and made a number of them, but not one dominant set of rules at that time we worked on.
Did you work very closely with the ICI?
Surely, of course. They were the for lack of a better word, lobbying organization, a fine outfit, and they would agree with us sometimes and disagree with us sometimes.
How did you and Marty Liebecker, right? Was he the...
He was the other associate director.
How did you divide up the work?
Well, it wasn't. It was previously divided for us. As I recall, I continued to have the chief counsel, which at that time would then report to me. So you had the interpretive arm, and then the disclosure area, which fitted my background as a, sort of a SEC lawyer in private practice. It was a natural fit. So the review of mutual fund prospectuses and so forth was something of a type I had done before.
Okay.
I specifically directed at mutual funds, but I knew from prospectuses and the like. And the third primary area was the investment advisor area.
Okay.
So, and then Marty would have tend to have rulemaking, I think, aspects and the insurance products.
Okay. You were also involved a little bit with something called the options study, is that right?
Only very briefly.
Okay.
I think I may have, well, extremely briefly, but not enough to even mention.
It was about that time you were getting ready to head over to corporate finance.
Well, no, that's why I started. It was asked to explore the option study, but then almost simultaneously, there was a very brief time at an option study. Ed Green had come in as the new director of corporation finance, mm-hmm. and I've been recommended to him, he asked me to be the deputy director of Corp Fin.
Okay.
And I was delighted to do, get a new area for me of responsibility. That was a subject matter I was familiar with from my private practice, of course. That's what I'd largely done in private practice, so that was a useful background.
Right, and it also been your specialty in the investment
exactly
management.
Exactly, so yeah.
Well, Corp Fin was going through something of a transition at that point, I guess, right?
Very productive time. It wasn't sort of going through; it was initiated by the staff.
Tell me about that.
One was the type that the review function, the basic putting aside the glossy rules that often get a great deal of attention. We certainly had major rule making at that time. It is largely, and the bulk of the staff, very able staff, is devoted to a review of disclosure documents, the text and the financial statements. And there was review. In fact, I brought a simple way for
some. Oh, excellent.
I didn't bring it much, but just on the review function. This was Business Week had an article on that, that what the SEC will do with all those filings here. There I am.
Huh.
So shaggy haired. It was major enough, for example, the Business Week would cover it in the Times, and there were articles in the Washington Post, and it was trying to have to improve the review process and maximize the staff we had. Of course, mm-hmm. the SEC was never replete with a great deal of money, and one perception was that we did not have enough staff, never had had, frankly, to review all the filings. So it became, how did you select which filings to do and then how to review them. It was sort of there was an organization by industry basis, by specialty, and divided, and then assigned to groups who would specialize in those areas. I mean, airlines or utilities right. or something seemed to be logical. And those were divided, and any group under, say, an assistant director, where I think was the level by which it was certainly divided then, would have assigned industries, and that would permit, we thought, a more informed review. The staff would tend to see the same, you know, repetitive sequences of issues. They could read and gather data. Those units would subscribe to literature in, say, for example, the airline industry and become more knowledgeable about it instead right. of sort of scattered and random. And I think that was a good idea, forced by necessity.
So it wasn't just a perception that you couldn't look at everything. You really
it's two different things. This was different from the quantity. This is the quality part. I'll come to the quantity.
Okay.
The one was just the quality part was to specialize by industry
right.
review, bring in expertise. People would have speakers to that group. Literature would be subscribed for and read by that group in that area and so mm-hmm. forth to be sort of a more intelligent review, or as intelligent as we could do, which was good. The staff was very capable. And then secondly was something called selective review. This is how much. It was clearly not enough staff personnel to review every filing. There never had been. And that it got sort of mushy in the past. I mean, people would make some obligation to make a pass, you know, at some time because it was a document on your table. We just couldn't do it. And it wasn't getting better. The country was growing. The staff was not growing and so forth. Staff initiated something called selective review. And that is just common sense as you select out on criteria which ones to review. And it was just a logical analysis. There would be some red flags. It was some trouble situation, of course. You would go look at it. There would be some. We developed some statistical measurements that seemed to be correct in identifying possible issues. You would have industry trends that might lead you to a review of certain findings when they came in. And some were done just randomly, again, to make sure that however intelligently designed it was, there was no one could feel that they were automatically coming through and that slipped something by.
Right.
So it was a combination of those. The staff itself worked as an entirety to develop those standards of selective review, and they were put in, and as far as we know, were fine. And they could be moderated, and were moderated over time with experience.
You talk about the staff implementing this.
Right.
I want to get a sense of how that was developed, though, because that's a pretty important change. Was this something that Ed Green talked to you about when he brought you in and said, you know, I really want to figure out a better way to do this?
I don't recall the origin that. It's been too many years, but Ed was the director, so he would certainly... be the person responsible for it.
Okay.
Primarily, I was the deputy director and so forth. And Ed was a very imaginative and a constructive man. And although there are many ideas in this, certainly many of them, he was responsible for all of them and undoubtedly initiated many of them. Probably this may have been one, but I don't recall specifically.
Did you get any pushback from farther up?
No.
How about support? Was this considered to be a good idea?
Yeah. And I think this is something that would generally be done at the staff level. You would expect to tell the commission what you were doing, of course, but it would be classically done by the staff, I think, here, knowing how it itself reviews things.
Okay.
It was logical. It was not controversial at the time. I think You could stop for a moment on the notion of, oh, you're not reviewing something at all, but then when you looked at the numbers, it became apparent that there just wasn't the staff to review everything, and to attempt to do that would water down the, ability to look at the documents as a whole. So it was controversial.
So you talked about you came in under Rod Hills, and then Harold Williams took over shortly after that.
Right.
Did you see a shift in focus at that?
It's hard to say. I think I was at Rod was my. It was too short a time in the first instance to make a comparison. Rod Hills was a fine man. It was such a short time I was there under him, it would be not fair to comment.
Well, give me your sense of the commission under Harold Williams. And what his
he was excellent, and over there he was there for several years when I was there, right. And we had strong. He was a strong chairman, and we had strong commissioners. They were very able. Chairman Williams was a former CEO, and I would say I would characterize his chairmanship as an able CEO, and that is he. Exerted appropriate control. He set the agenda, and it certainly would never see the light of day at the commission unless he was ready to have the item come up. He was meticulous about his personal view of matters of the nature that would come to the commission, and organized that way. So I would say that was the primary view there of a strong CEO who managed closely. The process.
Were you able to see the commission in action at this point when you were deputy?
At all stages.
Okay. So would you and Ed Green both be there and
when the commission? Yeah, we were there. We were there actively because we were active in rulemaking at the time, so we were up for that. But occasionally we would have comments on and a few other things, but. Well, an enforcement was regularly there because every enforcement action had to be approved by the commission. And often there were disclosure implications to that. So we would be expected to provide our comment on that. And so we were there a lot.
Can you give me an instance of that? Because, of course, this is a point at which enforcement is got a real high profile and is, giving the commission a lot of work to do. Tell me about some of the kinds of things that you would have been called in to.
Generally, it would be on an issue, and none of them are—they're all confidential. But of the type, it would be kind of interpretation of a rule or a requirement, and enforcement is appropriately aggressive. You want enforcement to be aggressive. The issue would be, and always, is that a fair reading of the rule, or is it a stretch to get someone? And or occasionally, I suppose, theoretically it's possible they would not stretch a rule far enough to cover something. As a practical matter, in reality, it tends to be more the reverse, that the prosecutor tends to take a very expansive view of a rule, and other people may disagree as to how the implications of that type of and their interpretation more broadly. That's the question. Because an enforcement action, in effect, becomes a rule. And if you take the position, this is what the rule says, then people, by and large, feel an obligation to follow that out there. Right. And that may, it depends on that, that may or may not be white, depending on the nature of the rule. Occasionally, by the way, enforcement would be there usually. Conversely, when we were proposing a rule or a major interpretation from their perspective on that. So it was a back and forth process, friendly and courteous generally, but active discussions. And discussions were always very open at the commission. There are two senses of open. I mean, the enforcement action generally would not be open to the public.
Right.
But within the commission, they were dynamic and they were very active. They had very good discussions, very thorough. And ultimately, the commission, by majority vote, would decide on those. And you would have a free set of expression of views before them.
Okay.
And that was regular.
Did you find yourself, in when Stanley Corkin was in and running enforcement, did you find yourself, you know, reminding them on, say, more occasions than later on?
No.
That they were stretching?
No.
During the Fetters years or something like that?
I was not enough to comment. I mean, Stanley was, I'm a fan of all those people. They were all very able. Mm-hmm. And it's more the nature of the beast, so to speak, than of a prosecutor than... it would be unfair of me to comment on that statistically. I don't have mm-hmm. a recollection of it as being that different.
Okay.
It may have been, but I don't recall it.
Well, what was the Ed Green went up to general counsel? Is that right?
Over to general. We always joked at Ed Corfin. That's a wonderful guy. We would say over to general counsel.
Okay, so he went over, about 81 or so.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay.
He's a very outstanding securities lawyer.
Was it pretty clear that you were going to get the top job there at that point?
It was virtually simultaneous, so I don't recall the details. They happened about the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because the chairman wanted Ed to be the general counsel time, which is fine. Therefore, that created an opening in his, and it just happened at the same time.
Okay.
As I recall.
Okay. Did you basically hit the ground running? Were there any surprises, or were there any things that you had to get used to?
No. Because when I was deputy director, actually, the extent was coterminous with that of the director. I mean, the scope was over the entire division, so I tended to do more operating type things as deputy director, you know, as a COO type things by analogy, but the subject matter areas were the same.
Okay. So I guess going back, you and Ed Green split things up a little bit on those, that corporate level where he's setting larger policy, and you're making sure
he would be more like a CEO, chief executive officer. I'd be more of a COO at that time, chief.
Okay.
Make sure the trains were running on time. For example, one thing we did in that period is we devised for everything that qualified as a project, that means a non-routine matter, we developed a piece of paper which had its due date, what it was, who was to do it, and how it was going to get done. And we kept it, and that would be agreed to by the people who were on the staff, and we reviewed it every week. To keep the trains moving on time, it was very organized. And we had we developed that ourselves, you know, as a monitoring thing, so that the things were kept on track by and large, and for clarity, and make sure things weren't falling back. As we concentrated on this, some smaller, particularly some deemed smaller. Things we may deem small may not be small to someone else.
Right.
And we all have a tendency to focus on a few matters for a variety of reasons. This was a device to make sure the trains were running on all tracks. That characterized our operations at that time.
You had a pretty experienced group of assistants, right?
Yes, we had associate directors, of course, and assistants. But the assistant, and they were all strong. And we had a mixture of people who had come in a little bit from the outside at the time, and then people who had been there for a long time. And both were valuable. And in the history of the tradition, the people who came in from the outside brought with them their experience from private practice, which was immense, which was very helpful, and brought that perspective. On the other hand, we had outstanding people there who'd made a career of the commission, who had great instincts, had seen it before. Howard Hodges was a great chief accountant of the Division of Corporation. I'm sure Howard could have left at any time and made a substantial amount of money more at private practice. He chose to stay there. As I recall, Howard was so sure. He liked to read annual reports for fun, so to speak. And he had a very good nose for problems. And he would come in over the weekend saying, Lee or Ed or whoever he was talking to, I think there may be an issue on this company. I think, you know, my sense tells me that they may be holding things on the loading dock, you know, and not. And that led to a lot of corrective action. And that was, you just can't, quote, buy that, unquote. Tremendous experience.
Would he have... You say he was working as an accountant?
Yes, I mean, yes.
Would he have been on call to all these various folks who were overseeing?
The accounting function in Corfin is very, very important. And the staff is a blend in Corfin, while there at least, typically some lawyers who reviewed, you know, more of the textual matters and, of course, the financials. But as has been said, the text is often just an elaboration of the financials. Right. And we had accountants throughout the commission, the division. Now, certainly, there was also an office of chief accountant for the commission as a whole,
right.
Largely Clarence Sampson when I was there, outstanding man. But there was also a chief accountant within Corp Fin, that was Howard Hodges. Now, they worked together. The office of chief accountant would typically had not review the documents. That was Corp Fin's job. They would set accounting policy as a whole. And then the review would take care on a difficult or major issue. Of course, there would be consultation both ways with the office of chief accountant. We had a sturdy core of good accountants in Corp Fin who would look at the financial statements and that where often the most important matters are.
Did they specialize in these groups that you were talking about? Somebody's doing transportation.
Well, they'd be with the group, yeah.
Yeah.
At the time, so okay. Which was helpful for them.
Did those shift over time? Did people move from one area to the other?
Probably, normally through a promotion or something like that. At the time I was there, you know, there was not that many years, you know, with the process, so
right.
I would think there'd be rotation from time to time, but it wasn't.
Okay.
Wouldn't need to force it too much by that shorter period comparatively.
You mentioned rules as well, and you know some of those things that pop up. Any landmarks in that?
Oh, there were. It was probably it was as an active time in rulemaking as there's been, in those years. The major focus was called integrated disclosure,
right.
And this was a process of many years of sort of well preceded those years, although it reached its culmination and finalized basically around 84 or so. But as you recall, there are filings you make periodically, any company filer will make annual reports, quarterly reports, the like, 10Ks, 10Qs. And there are one-shot or episodic disclosures like a prospectus to come from time to time. And as a man named Milton Cohen pointed out in the 60s, a famous article, I believe, in the Harvard Law Review, that things in a way were backward. They had a lot of documents in the one-time, information in the long one-time public offering, that very little in the periodic files, whereas the trading volume that was underlain by the periodic reporting dwarfed the amount of sales, for example, done in public, sort of backwards. So over time, the essence was to beef up the information being provided regularly in the quarter to the investing public through annual and quarterly reports and the like, which correlative would then allow less information being put physically in a prospectus to be delivered by a prospectus, because it was already there, as duplicative, an investor could obtain it otherwise. And that, having said that simply, that was a large project.
Right. Didn't Louis Loss do some work in that area?
Well, he was a professor. That was a different, I mean, I'm sure he would have commented on it, but and there was a federal securities code he did, and that's okay. Different, really.
Okay.
But this was initiated in prior administrations, came out and sort of was very active in that period. Most of the rules got passed in the years we were there and vetted and all like that. And there were some parts that had particular interest. You had always issues related to international disclosure versus domestic, versus rulemaking there that raised important issues of how much you require foreign companies or to invest in not. And then certainly the thing that reached the most attention as a part of that was something called shelf registration or Rule 415. And there had always been something called shelf registration, put it in sort of guides. And there were a lot of informal guides around. So a part of this project was also to say it should either be a rule or not. You know, they had an indeterminate status, and so let's put it one way. And by the way, this would be a good opportunity to dust these rules off for public comment, see if they're still these guidelines and policies were still valid or not. That added a great amount of bulk to this project, but very worthwhile. There had always been something called shelf registration in a policy, and this was moving it to a rule.
Okay.
However, it was news. The feature was it sort of represented things coming together. It was short-form perspectives. No review in some cases, which was going on, as we saw. I mean, but it was well-known companies tend to be well-known companies with no singular issues that didn't require review. And and now a shelf registration, which even facilitated it, meant very rapid opening offerings. It also meant, as a practical matter, there could be more competition among underwriters because you weren't tied to the process as you might be for 6 or months. Easy for a company to go pick another one if you got a lower for whatever reason. So a combination of issues came up so that it sort of became a brouhaha. In fact, this was the other. What is this? Sorry. Mm-hmm. But see, widespread publicity, and the commission held hearings on it, it was finally adopted. It was pretty much as proposed. It was a temporary rule for a year or two, you may recall, and then finally adopted. But it was very dynamic times. A lot of the commentary was very strong. And there were public hearings on it. And this is the type of disclosure. I'm just pointing to a document here. Mm-hmm. Here we are and that sort of thing.
Yep.
It was ultimately, as I said, in place and seems to have worked. There were estimates of substantial cost savings involved. Mm-hmm. And it's been operating ever since.
You describe this as something that was sort of emerging slowly out of the background. Is that fair to say? Were you thinking in these terms when you first came into CorpFin? Thinking about this integrated disclosure in general?
Well, yes and no. I mean, as I said, there had been rulemaking in the area of integrated disclosure before.
Right.
It certainly accelerated when we were there through a variety of reasons. I think mostly just events. There had been a corporate disclosure report that made recommendations in this area by a blue ribbon panel. The passage of time, the staff allocations related to that. There had been short form usages before. It was sort of a coming together of a variety of areas. And then it moved to PACE, where Ed, and I give Ed some credit of taking an aggressive, appropriate aggressive task toward moving this through.
In what way? Did he put together a group that was going to focus
on this? No, it was the same people. It was just saying, let's go do this. Get the integrated disclosure done and move the guides to yay or nay into rules and move across the board. So at that period, I think he showed leadership in terms of getting the movement going.
And the whole shelf registration thing really emerges into public view, at least, just about the time that you took over.
Yeah, exactly. So that was something that was a hallmark, in a way, so to speak, when I was there.
Why did that happen exactly? I mean, that was just the logic of this building of events that you talked about? Or was the commission involved in any way?
Well, the odd thing about it is it, in a way, was just a codification with what was happening anyway. And I think we were familiar with that on the staff, not because we're brighter. We just worked with it every day. But a lot of investment bankers, particularly senior investment bankers, highly intelligent, able people, had been away from this. So the entire totality seemed strikingly new, and to them not good. I think... and it came up a little bit coincidentally. I think the competitive aspect, frankly, also played a feature in it, and why it sort of reached attention. And a couple of fine investment banking leaders immediately took strong public action to protest or object. And because the train had gone way down the track, so to speak, they took it particularly strongly. I guess they felt they had to raise the issue strongly, because there was a lot of water under the bridge on that particular rule at that point. And originally, no one objected to the rule particularly.
John Whitehead was one of them.
And a very able man. He was sincere in his views. So it's sort of one of those things. It brought up into a tremendous sort of heat or attention at the time. But the commission, I believe, handled it appropriately. The commission held public hearings. They were widely expressed. Corporations tend to applaud it. Many of the investment bankers did not. Some did. We thought the best thing to do overall, the commission decided, was to put it in action on a temporary basis and see what happens.
Right.
They did, and nothing malign seemed to have happened. We saw it. So after a period of time, a kink here or there was adjusted, not much, and it was put into place. And after that, the world moved on. I personally, even as a staff member, take no particular credit for it. I think it was more of a sign of the times, mm-hmm. Than the operation of the rule itself. It's just these things happen. I think you couldn't really go backward. It would have been a mistake to go backwards in that. Mm-hmm. It'd be like King Canute rolling back the waves at that point, I think.
There was a general deregulatory environment at that point, too, in all aspects of the federal government.
It was, although, of course, the Harrell was a Democratic administration when he was there, and although it was sort of deregulatory, and then, of course, Chairman Shadd was a Republican, so it was both parties. And I think there was that. I think it was probably less ideological than, I think we were on the staff, were of a variety of, no one ever asked what political party you were in, and many of us were Democrats, others were Republican, sort of made no difference. It was that probably over years it was time for some effort like that, because rules had tended to just aggregate. Mm-hmm. And perhaps after New Deal time they tend to be somewhat heavy-handed, frankly. So it was not inappropriate for some pragmatic look to be taken about the need for that. There was some extreme regulation, interpretation. If you wrote a book, for example, in the investment advisory area, there was a staff view that you had registered as an investment advisor virtually, and that just was silly. Well-intentioned originally, but a little bit of that. So I think the goal being taken at the time, as I said, was not an ideological one. And we things were increased. For example, and Court Finn, the commission adopted a rule with the annual report that they had to be signed, and executives did not like that. Hmm. Well, that was a discipline. Since we put more emphasis on the annual reports, we thought more emphasis should be paid on the annual reports. So they were actually beefed up. So the idea was more or less, it was just more efficient regulation. So there were increases in the periodic filings, reductions in allowable in the prospectus.
I guess you must have seen this as sort of rationalizing.
It was rationalizing. It was not less. I mean, not ideologically, just less. It was trying to make it. It's like you could take a 50-pound burden. If you wrapped it around your ankle, it would be tough to walk. If you put it in a backpack, you could probably move pretty easily, and that's the difference. We were trying to put the backpack on the back, not around the ankle.
It did appear that this was something that John Shadd supported. I mean, was that fair to say that this was something that he picked up and helped move forward?
No, largely in that he noticed he's an old investment banker, the reaction to the shelf rule itself when it came out, but he went along with it. The end of the day,
So the investment bankers were just basically concerned that this would mean less business.
That's unfair. I said that was an aspect. I think in their view at the time, they were worried about the express view was less due time for due diligence, and input. Someone else would say, if you had no review, in effect, which we had, independent of the shelf rule and short forms, two-page, one-page prospectus, there's not much to work on anyway. So the addition of the shelf rule isn't that much. He tended to conflate, one would argue, conflate several different things that were all already there. But that was the issue, largely, that was raised, and I'm sure it was well-intentioned. Mr. Whitehead was remembering, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but so I won't personalize it, but some people may have been remembering the days when you had 30-page prospectuses and you were in there. I worked on it myself when I was much younger. Mm-hmm. When I was younger, when we would, we actually said, I remember a bond offering. I looked at one of my first ones I worked on, and we began in November, and we had a closing date scheduled for March, and we worked to that, schedule. Four months later, we financed, and of course that would be shelved out in 5 minutes today. So there was a memory of those days, I think, but a completely understandable worry about the ability to have input. we just thought it was not really properly focused on the shuffle per se. It really had more to do with the totality of the current regulatory structure.
Right.
And that to try to do something otherwise would not make sense. I mean, if you had no review, for example, and you had a prospectus that incorporated everything by reference, why just wait at the commission? Nothing much would happen except a loss of opportunity as a practical matter. But those were the issues that were raised. And
speeding things up, getting rid of this, 4-month time lag you talked about or something, is going to change the way business gets done.
Clearly. That's right. And a part that, too, was either it was a reaction to it, but a coincidence. The Fed just began, Mr. Volcker, I believe, at least around those times, to manage the monetary policy by more rapid adjustments. So back in the days I was talking about, there were very few interest rate changes by the Fed. And so it didn't make any difference so much when you had a financing. That changed dramatically. So it made a great deal of difference when you came to market. And would cost the shareholders a bundle, theoretically, if you had to wait for no purpose. And so there was also a blending with the way finance worked at the time.
Now, there was a little bit of controversy on the commission with that, with Commissioner Thomas.
Yes.
Put out a statement or something?
Right.
What was your role? Were you called upon to come in from time to time and present, okay, here's the implications of this particular part of shelf registration?
Of course, we work for the commissioners. We're the staff, and we would come down individually if a commissioner wanted to talk about something specific, which they did from time to time. On their own or in a meeting as a whole. And so we would do both those from time to time on a variety of different issues. And if they wanted, obviously it was our job to keep them informed. They are the ones adopting the rule, not the staff. Mm-hmm. We did all that.
Any memorable experiences as far as that is concerned, commissioners that turned to you more than others pursued things in perhaps a more diligent manner or just seeking more information?
They all did. And the commissioners were very effective when I was there. And they were also sharp. I remember Commissioner Loomis, who was unusually, well, they were all very bright, but I think Phil may have been valedictorian's class at Princeton and Yale or he had an exceptional intellect. And I remember when I was first there, a long memo for him on some subject, I wrote it. And he called me a few days later. I said, "Oh, excellent, Mr. Spencer. I agree with the recommendation," so forth like that. But footnote number 73 on page 39 is a little vague to me. He missed nothing. You know, any slight imprecision, of expression or thinking, would be spotted. So it was a high standard.
And of course, he knew his way around the commission.
Yes,
he wasn't just coming in from the outside.
And the commission, I think, worked very effectively when I was there. I must say, because they were commissioners were all able. They did not come from the same perspective, which I think is good. And I won't characterize them; just came from different slants on views on a different issue. But it was all very open and expressed, and the discussions were healthy. I don't recall any that were hostile or acrimonious. There must maybe something human nature being what it is, but very active, very vivid. And having five commissioners and a variety of staff there meant things got pretty well hashed out. I don't think that there was no missing of a point. It got discussed. And my recollection is it came out well. The right result, as one could understand it, got implemented at that time. There was no political input whatsoever when I was there. You'd occasionally get a call from a congressman or someone like that, and you'd be, "Thank you, congressman," and goodbye. there was no malign issue. I think the only time in my period I can recall any commentary about that, it came up in one book. It was a major insurance company. Where the staff, Corfin, my unit, and the chief accountant suggested a quite major write-down, several hundred million dollars. And they actually, it would have a major impact on them, of course, and they asked to meet with the commission. And the chairman said, fine, I guess on the theory that, you know, give up them a day in court. And some, I recall reporters that later, or someone writing a book later, took issue with that. And I think their lawyer may, because there was an empty chair, happened to have sit up at the commissioner. And they, someone found that to be untoward. It was actually just casual. In fact, the commission affirmed the staff's decision. And there was a write-down of several hundred million dollars. And the company understood that. They did not like that, you know, at all. But they thought at least the process was open. We explained the reasons why, you know, mm-hmm. hopefully were logical, and they did that. So, so again, I think that there was the commission worked very well at dealing with and not being affected by pressure, be it political or from private interests.
And you talked about Harold Williams sort of being, you know, the CEO and running, right. knowing how to run his commission.
Right.
Did you see John Chad doing things?
He was just different. I won't say one is better than the other. That's inappropriate, and I won't say that. Both fine chairmen. Outstanding. Chairman Chad would tend to let things come to the commission, you know, even though he might disagree with them. Mm-hmm. And that's would be the difference. And so sometimes the discussions were particularly feisty because it certainly wasn't pre-orchestrated. Mm-hmm. I recall his being in the minority, for example, at some time, which was fine with him. And there's something noble about it, I suppose. It is a commission of five commissioners. And the main power, as I understood it, of the chairman it was the power of this, you know, the agenda. And appointments, and naturally, generally they would consult, of course, the others anyway on both those topics. Mm-hmm. But that was the difference with Chairman Chad.
Was there a sense in the early '80s that the staff was still having a great deal of input and able to really influence?
Oh, it always has. Yeah, it always has. It's certainly there was as a whole a very able staff, and I think any commissioner would be inclined to respect the views and work of that able group. Commissioners had the final say, that's appropriate. It worked as the way it should.
Well, let's touch on some of the other things. I would assume that shelf registration and you know, sort of being the culmination of integrated disclosure, is that fair to say?
Well, part of it. It was in the final rule set. Yeah, it got the most publicity, but it was that plus the other rules that sort of were put in place at that time. Okay. That integrated disclosure basically got done and remained in place, I must say, substantially since then.
What were some of the other components that we haven't talked about at this point?
Just the content of the forms themselves. Literally, what disclosure is made. I mean, the substantive requirements on a whole, all the panoply of documents were all reviewed and modified. It was a very substantial project. The rule making project goes on for hundreds of not more pages in this area.
Did you set up task forces, or how did you divide up the work?
Yeah, right, and we did, and it was all assigned out again. Along the way, we said we're monitoring the weekly, you know, on a weekly basis, the mm-hmm. progress of the work, and then the other thing that came, it sort of relates to it. If you don't treat this as a different topic, as Edgar, and mm-hmm. That was the electronics were coming on the scene at the time. In terms of filing and then retrieving information by computer. And not to personalize it, other people had that. I gave a speech, called the Electric Library, Electronic Library. Hmm. In 82, it was republished in the Journal of Accountancy. That sort of launched, it came from discussions internally, launched the idea publicly. And it began to be implemented more when I left, you know, than when I did. But it was done, I think, I, among other things, suggested that largely you subcontract out the work to people who understood computers better than we did, and that was right. largely done. On the theory that ultimately the thing that really would make integrated disclosure work is the ability to get it instantly, you know, on the computer. And then you don't need a long prospectus if you can instantly just tap the information in.
Right.
And it's all logical. And we knew there would be a period as the computer spread itself throughout the country. And the more it spread, of course, the more you can justify relying on electronic disseminated information and not paper. And a tipping balance has been moving that way ever since. But at least we spotted that at the time and initiated the rulemaking and staffing that resulted in the Edgar system.
What were you able to initiate? I mean, at this point, there's still a lot of mainframe computers, not as many, yeah. not that many PCs.
Just the idea. We got the project started during my tenure there, and just got it rolling, mm-hmm. basically, put it that way.
There are some interesting issues that come up. I recall things about if it's posted online, does that mean, is that notification, you know, in the legal sense or the technical sense versus paper?
There are some
issues like that. Did you think through things like that or anticipate
some of those?
Yeah, best
we could, and there would be, but we thought most of the things would be worked. It's just, in general, much better for all sorts of reasons mm-hmm. now. And paper is very clumsy. And you know, if there would be time for as younger people get used to them, but now we're already there, I'm sure, where people automatically, I certainly do.
Right.
We're moving away from newspapers, regrettably. But beyond that, for our research, we go online now, certainly do.
Right.
And that's just part of it. It's much easier.
So that's something you handed off, I guess, when you
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you sort of stands out as a landmark of your time as director?
Well, they also had Regulation D, which private placements. They were the public offerings, but we also did major rulemaking regarding private placements as well.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that. The idea is that it becomes easier to do a private placement, less reporting.
And also clarify the standards of what is a valid private placement and what is not. And
what were the standards?
Oh, they were divided up. And the other thing is to put it in a systematic place.
Okay.
And it is somewhat elaborate and technical, but it made more orderly. Instead of a series of no action letters and interpretive devices where there was a great deal of judgment, inefficient judgment, it was placed in a rule so you could have a more exact response of when you could and when you couldn't. It's helpful. In fact, a general, stepping back, mm-hmm. look at all this. A goal was to make this all accessible to every man. When I was younger, before this time, it tended to be arcane and known to the priesthood. You know, mm-hmm. basically some law firms would have a great advantage because they had histories of no action letters in their files. And if you were a member of the public, you really had to go to what I call a priest, you know, for access. Well, no one would think that's an ideal system. It really should be open to all, and the public should know the standards. Anyone should be able to approach the commission and comply with our rules. So that's why the older no action letters and rule, these interpretations and guides, things of that fuzzy stature, were basically dumped and placed either in a rule by and large or an instruction to a rule or not. Mm-hmm. The rules would all be public. And anyone can go them, and then now on computer you can find them even more readily. But that was, and so we laughed, and we said, we're all working ourselves out of a job. What you're supposed to do is to make things so complex that only you can interpret them, retain when you go back to private practice. We did the opposite.
In a sense, it's like the paradigm shift where things build up, all kinds of things build up, and you have to, at some point, you reconcile them and sort of turn them over.
That's right. We've been filling up the attic as some sort of order of the attic. But the second, this last point was a little bit different. It was intentional to make it also more transparent mm-hmm. to anyone at this time.
Right. And I suppose that would go along with the general, the fact that just 10 years earlier there was a much smaller public that was investing. It had grown significantly.
Exactly, the entire country.
What was behind your decision to leave the SEC?
I've always been a believer that you do a job and then move on and give someone else a chance. You don't. At some point, you wind up defending your own policies and determinations and so forth. And I feel that sort of dogmatically or doctrinally mm-hmm. that you do it for a time and then give someone else a chance. The pressure and that sort of thing.
Did you consider other kinds of government work? Or elsewhere?
Not at that time. No. I was ready to return to private practice. Okay. And I think, for me at least, there was an advantage in doing both. I think both in each role informs the other. I think I was a better governmental official having been in private practice and seeing where they are, and vice versa.
Yeah. In what way? Tell me a little bit about that. Because it seems like the standard for the SEC in a lot of ways is straight out of law school, going to the SEC, and then into
Well, my day, they always had a blend. We always had a number of people who had been in private practice and came over at all levels.
Okay.
It was never much of a sacrifice in our area, which is a highly compensated area of securities lawyers, to go into the commission. It was a period of time, but you could generally return to a highly compensated area. So I would not claim it was any sacrifice to do it particularly. If anything, it's an enormous privilege and advantage. But the advantage to me of having been in private practice was to, again, work on a number of different types of companies firsthand and understand them better. Also, probably psychologically, to know that not all companies are bad. You know, there's a converse in the government, you know, that by and large, most situations, people are honest and try to do their best if you give them a chance and do it, and that was good. I then learned when I went, and of course all our clients were honest and well-meaning. I then learned when I went to the commission, of course, I quickly learned that not everyone is like that. And that was also a badge. You have to watch it. There are problems out there. You have to cut the guards. And so I think appropriate that I didn't demonize private, you know, practice having been there. On the other hand, when I came back to the private sector, I learned to be very careful about, you know, the clients, and not everyone's honest, and there are problems out there, and under stress, many people, and wonderful people, will do very unfortunate things. That was useful. Again, in private practice, if you're fortunate working at a great firm, you will be taught also standards of practice, how to do a job right, mm-hmm. and have that drilled in, and that was useful for me, I think. That's sort of a general mm-hmm. tool.
You went to Gibson Dunn, and right. did you specialize in mergers, that sort of thing?
No, I have a broad field, and I had admired that firm. It was a great firm. I liked the tone of it, and so forth. And I joined in the Washington office. My wife then had a wonderful job at the Smithsonian, but after within a space of a year, they were sort of opening up. This was the period where out-of-town firms were opening up in New York, and Gibson, okay. a great firm, was opening in New York, and the firm asked if I would go to New York to help start it up. There were a handful of people at the time there. My wife is from there, so, and I practiced there before, so it's natural. We went back and practiced. I was a partner there for the next 10 years.
Okay. How did your experience with the SEC influence the way you were working, other than sort of the philosophical viewpoint that you talked about?
The simplest way, I knew about subject matters, a broader variety of subject matters. Mutual funds, where we started, I wound up advising a number of mutual funds and advisors or boards of directors, mutual funds. That's an interesting area, and I would not have had that before. It was an area of expertise I had had. And again, through a combination of my earlier experience and the SEC, I guess I would characterize by just a variety of subject matters, good or bad. I always worked on an extraordinary variety of types of matters. So
different industries, different kinds of financial or reorganizations.
Transactions, advised types, you name it. I sort of worked across the board. And so it was interesting. And then so one interesting feature, I guess, at Gibson Dunn was we represented the first Chinese company to make a public offering in the United States public in 1992, and that was a great adventure. We went to China and worked on it. It was sort of not public at the time we did it, but we did our diligence and talked to various governmental ministries. It was an automobile manufacturing company, minivan. And visited the plant and talked to them. It was absolutely absorbing. It was glamorous in the end. We went to a closing dinner with our limousines being escorted by police through Beijing, and we're invited over to their White House and met Jiang Zemin, the head of China, the next day, who was very interested in things like electronic trading here at the Chicago Trading Space. Very intelligent man and sharp. And then having done that, as so often, we did several more China deals because people want to find the people who've done the deal, you know,
right.
before.
Right.
So the remainder of my time there, I was working on, to a substantial amount, on deals from China. My partner, Sandy Rand, who's currently our ambassador to China, was the, sort of the Hong Kong partner. He was flowing on this sort of the Wall Street-ish partner on those deals. So that was...
Hmm.
fascinating.
Had you had much experience with international affairs in
the FCC? Someone said, I remember even in law school, one of my professors, John Deutsch, said you could practice international law in the middle of a cornfield in Iowa. But, you know, there are many aspects of international matters that interlace, and sure, I mean, either domestic companies financing abroad or having foreign operations or vice versa, it would always be around in some form.
Right. I guess the question is, how much was this an issue for CorpFin at the time? Was it something that...
It was always an issue because there is it's a tough area intellectually. And because if you ask for the same amount of information from a foreign company as a U.S. company, it is unusual for them in their own country. And often burdensome and can raise competitive issues. On the other hand, from the investing point of view, there is no reason not to want the same information from a foreign company. And so it's a tough area. And there's no automatic right answer. The main crunch comes in the accounting area. And the commission is still working on those issues. We tend to make some modifications toward it, international structure, but the core of it remained the same. As a practical matter, the information that had to be provided,
right. And that's fairly early on too. I mean, the international issues didn't really rise to a high profile.
They were always around. There would be there'd be an interest in it because the more, frankly, from a business point of view, the easier it was, the more deals would be done here. Right. People would make money. Nothing wrong with that, you know. So there was always an interest in that. It goes in peaks and valleys. I think certainly over time there was a greater interest in, after we left, in companies coming here.
Right.
Where that would be now, I don't know. May or may not.
Something else I would just want to touch on is you left Gibson Dunn and you went into Prudential Securities.
Yeah, they
very interesting.
Yeah,
circumstance.
They had some issues. Long series of limited partnerships, so I was asked to come in and be the general counsel there.
A long series of...
They had problems with selling limited partnerships.
Okay.
And there was an elaborate process set up, sort of a remedial process to pay back people who claimed to have been adversely affected, which was part of it. But there were a million other issues. It was a wonderful time, but very demanding. Being the general counsel of a broker dealer like that, very broad operations.
Were you looking at how to put things, set things right again? I guess is that
sure. As is always the case, right? Yeah. And there would be particular attention at that time to that. So anyway, but it was a very good but demanding job. There are to give you an order of magnitude, there'd probably be 100 lawyers on the staff. So there, okay. Just the administrative part would be significant.
Yeah.
And then there would be always, like any big company, high-profile company, it's high-profile issues to grapple with.
That's a lot more people that you're managing than in CorpFin, I suppose, right?
No, I have to add, more lawyers, I think.
More lawyers.
CorpFin was big. I'm not even sure how many. We may have had that many. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
At the time, quite a few. It was just different. Okay. You know, it was just different. And it was a... privilege for me. I also taught at Georgetown Law School when I was there for several years. So personally, it was interesting to have worked in private practice in the government, and then on the inside counsel job, sort of saw all that. And each has its advantages and its disadvantages, of course.
Did you move back to D.C. then?
No. That was just here.
Okay. Well, is there anything that we haven't touched on that?
I think those were the marquee.
Okay.
Features.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Sure.
Appreciate it.